live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The King stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern, live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.
My brother called and said my mother was on her deathbed. So I flew back to New Jersey, and luckily, she was very unhappy in life. She just turned 89, and she just shut down. So there was no medical reason other than I think I'm not happy here right now. And I think my mom just said, if this is what it's going to be, I'm out of here. So we all came home. She had six children, and we started taking care of her and learned all the tips and tricks because we didn't know how long mom was going to be with us. I have a chapter in the book called A Silent Scream. So I think it was a cry for help. She wanted her kids back, if not her kids, at least some love in the house.
Welcome to the True Fiction Project, a podcast series that explores the origins of fiction. Every week, we begin with an interview, nonfiction, followed by a creative piece, fiction, inspired by something from the interview. The idea is to demonstrate, of course, that fiction is born out of our life experiences. Now, here's your host, storyteller, author, public speaker, health and wellness expert, Renita Hora.
Welcome to the True Fiction Project. I am your host, Renita Hora. And you know how much I love comedy. If you've been listening to this podcast, if you've read any of my work, I thrive on, you know, anything that tickles the funny bone. So today I have another such guest who I am thrilled to interview. He is Mark Stephen Porro. He is a New Jersey native, in fact, exit 163. That is very specific, but he doesn't live in New Jersey these days. So we'll ask him about that. But most importantly, he is an award-winning writer, director, designer, and now an award-winning author. So lots of jokes, several screenplays, and an award-winning short film. But we're here to talk about his new book, A Cup of Tea on the Commode. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the True Fiction Project.
Bonjour. That's the hint. Thanks very much.
That is definitely a hint to take the exit, meaning not exit 163. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. What exit would it be? Anyway, yeah. So I live in a little village called Pézenas in southwest France, and it's in the largest wine-growing region in the world, which is lovely. I joke, I tell people that if you throw a grape, you hit a wine domain. And the wine's excellent, and it's actually cheaper than water here, which is scary if you can't control yourself. But they also say Molière was born in this town. He wasn't actually born. The writer, Jean-Baptiste, I think it's Paquin, was sponsored by Prince Conti to come down here, and he developed into Molière here. He wrote Tartuffe and The Misanthrope here, and I think a few other of his big plays, and became Molière. So they say he was born here.
So what you're trying to tell us is you moved to this town because of Molière and not because of the wine, cheap wine.
No,
right?
That's not true. The Molière is the icing on the cake, but the cake is wine, solid wine. Yeah, it's very cool. And my place is, they say it was built in 1540. There's a lot of stone, and the village is filled with cobblestone and a lot of architectural, political history and theater history, of course, and artists of all kinds are here. It's just a very cool, creative place.
Yeah, I can see some of that stone and the wine behind you, and it looks incredible. I'm extremely jealous. I would much rather be there, although San Francisco's pretty nice today. But you have done so much, Mark. I mean, I don't even know where to begin to ask you how you began or what. I mean, you're a writer, you're a director, you've done some acting, you've been an entrepreneur. How did all of this come together, you know, as part of your storytelling journey?
Well, I grew up in a very creative household. My mother was very much into the arts. We all got into, I mean, she was a painter, and also I went to Catholic school, and I was painting oil paintings in kindergarten. They were horrible, but we were working with oil back then, and it was just lovely. And then my mother got us all into the ballet. So we all started performing in the ballet. And I grew up in a suburb of New York City. So we were involved with some really nice productions. Actually, my start was in Lincoln Center with the Royal Danish Ballet when I was around 7 years old. So it was a good start. And I got paid $5 a show. And that beat some of my years in Hollywood. It was a good start. But I retired at around 11 from the ballet. It wasn't like shin splints or anything like that. I moved on to baseball, and then I quit baseball for girls. And, you know, we know where that ends. Yeah. So
interesting. Ballet to baseball, decided that's baseball for girls. Okay. Yeah. What took you to Hollywood when considering your very early retirement from ballet?
Well, I think that, you know, I still had the creative bug, and my family was all pretty creative, and both of my parents were very funny people, and luckily they passed some of that on to us. So I went to Ohio State and got a degree in industrial design, which is a nice mix of, I loved math and science, but I also loved the arts. And so this was a beautiful fusion of three of my loves. And so that fed my creative side. And then I think it was, I had a receptionist at one design firm I worked for, and she was modeling. And then she said, oh, you should try modeling. And I was like, all right, you know, so maybe for some extra money. So I actually started doing that. And then I started getting cast in commercials. And then I started thinking about, you know, I liked performing as a kid, so maybe I should try this. So I had a connection out in Hollywood with an agent. And I also had a really good design portfolio. So I actually landed a design job. So I didn't start, you know, being a waiter or anything like that. I had a good design job waiting for me, and I started studying acting. And yeah, LA was great. I moved out there in 84, and I wanted to be a good actor. I didn't want to be a flash in the pan. So I started studying from day one and continued studying almost the whole time I was there. And my goal was to get on a show like Hill Street Blues, because that was one of the top shows at the time. And less than 2 years later, I got on Hill Street Blues as the assistant DA. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
My goodness. So you assistant DA?
Just one episode.
One episode.
One episode. But it was a lovely introduction, because you're working, you know, with big time actors and a high quality show. And so that was a lovely start, and you get kind of spoiled. So after that, I didn't work for like 7 months, and that's the normal acting life. So.
Yay. So what might we have seen you in?
Well, the Hill Street Blues. In fact, my nephew just, I think about a year ago, he saw a rerun of this thing, which is like 35 years later. And he shot a picture of it and sent it to me over here in France, which was very funny.
What episode? We got to check this out.
It's a horrible name. It was Case of Clap. Not clap as in a disease, but a clap was the name of a guy that was on trial at the time. So
I see.
I did a lot of television, a bunch of shows. They can look up on IMDb. But my biggest TV role, I was the drug lord on Walker, Texas Ranger. I think they're second to last season. And I don't want to ruin it, but I get killed at the end. And my sister, when she saw that, she said, I know it's acting, but my gosh, it's hard to watch your brother get shot on TV. That was lovely. And Chuck was a lovely guy, and his son directed that episode. But that same year, that was in 1999. That same year, I also had a very small part. Though it's been a wonderful financial success, I had a small part in Castaway with Tom Hanks, directed by Robert Zemeckis, and Steven Spielberg produced it. So you're working with these guys, and Spielberg was on set for a couple of the days I was there, and it was lovely. And Tom Hanks is as lovely as everybody says he is. He's just a really good guy. But you're sitting in a chair, like when I was getting, you're sitting in the makeup trailer, and I'm in a chair, and I'm getting paid, you know, a few thousand dollars. And you got Tom Hanks a chair away, and he's making like $20 million. And it's just hard to put that into perspective, because he's such a nice guy. If he was a jerk, he'd say, you're such a lucky guy. But he's, a lucky guy also, but he's just a sweetheart.
A nice lucky guy. Well, you have an award-winning short film of your own, though. Tell us about that.
Well, okay. So the entrepreneuring thing was a big deal. So since you have a lot of time in between acting, I had a pretty strong creative side. So I started a bunch of companies. I said I've started 5 nonprofits, but none of them were intended to be nonprofits. So during one of my nonprofits, it was a snack food company. I started to honor my dad, and he had a half pop popcorn he invented in 1963. That was just a secret family recipe for years. And before he passed, I said, you know, we should really do something with this. So I started testing it in Hollywood, and it became kind of my calling card. It was lovely, and people went crazy over it. And then I started doing research and found out there was still nothing 40 years later on the market. So It was a very, very cool product. It was originally called Nutri-Nuts, is what my dad called it, but there was no nuts in it. So we changed it to Grandpa Poe's Originals, and we went nationwide with it. We were the snack a day on Rachel Ray, and we were organic. So we got into all the health food stores, Whole Foods and Wild Oats at the time, but also in major chains like Safeway. It was a good run, but again, I was an actor, and this thing was pretty much 24/7, but I wanted to get back into it. So I wrote this short film, which was a parody on Law and Order. Law and Order, you know, they had several of them, but one of them was SVU, and everybody called it SUV. And a friend of mine was one of the executive producers, and I said, wouldn't it be funny if someone shot the entire film inside an SUV? And so that's what I wrote. And yeah, so the murder takes place inside the SUV, the courtroom scene and investigation all take place. So there's like 29 actors in that car, I think, at one point, because we had a full jury. Or nine in the back, and then four up on the moonroof that peeked in, and the judge sat in the driver's seat, and the witnesses sat in the passenger seat, and the defense attorney and the prosecutor were in the second seat with the witnesses and the accused. So it was a lot of fun. It's on the YouTube. It's SUV, sport utility vehicle. And so that won a comedy award in a festival in Texas way back when. So that's my award making thing in the film world. But it was fun, and it was all union work. It was a micro budget, and I got everybody, all my professional acting friends, to jump in. The Soup Nazi from Seinfeld is actually in it. He's a good friend of mine, so he has a good part in there.
So more of your work that we just have to check out. So what took you to then writing a book?
Well, I did some copywriting while I was designing, and then I started a greeting card company, so I started that kind of writing.
Another one of your nonprofits, greeting cards?
Yeah, if you want to rub it in, yeah.
Oh,
that was it was potentially could have been great, but yeah, that wasn't. So I got into all kinds of stuff, and then when you're in Hollywood, you're improvising and you're creating characters and things like that. And then I actually had an audition class where the teacher said it's a 6-week course to get you all prepped up for the cold auditions, and he said at the end of the class, you're all going to write a scene. And you're going to cast it and have other actors perform your scene. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in Hollywood. This is big time. So this is scary. I was very scared to do it. But I wrote a scene and I cast these two guys that were brilliant. And I was hooked because it went over great. And I said, OK, I think I can do this. So I started writing screenplays, and I did stand up for a while. So you're always looking for the funny in anything, any situation. So in 2011... when everything was going great on the West Coast in my carefree bachelor life, I had no children, never married or anything like that. And my brother called and said my mother was on her deathbed. So I flew back to New Jersey, and luckily, I think, a kind of a self-determined. She was very unhappy in life. She just turned 89 and she just shut down. So there was no medical reason other than I think I'm not happy here right now. And she was in the home we grew up in, but we had some people in there that were kind of taking care of her, and they did not get along. And I think my mom just said, if this is what it's going to be, I'm out of here. So we all came home. She had 6 children, and we started taking care of her. And my younger sister and I hung out with hospice and learned all the tips and tricks because we didn't know how long mom was going to be with us. So we wanted to take care of her as much as we could. So I think that I have a chapter in the book called A Silent Scream. So I think it was a cry for help. She wanted her kids back. If not her kids, at least some love in the house. And so we provided that. And about 3 weeks later, she kind of snapped out of it.
I see.
And later in the year, I decided that she deserved better. And so I moved back into my childhood home at 55.
Wow. So A Silent Scream from A Cup of Tea on the Commode. Is that what you're going to read for us today?
No. That was no. Well, that's not actually the one I did. You shouldn't have built up the funny stuff because the book has a lot of funny stuff in it. And maybe as we're talking, you get a hint. But what I'm going to read is not funny, but it's an important part of the book, I think. And after I read this, I'll read another thing, which is actually the opening of the book, which to me, I kind of envisioned as an opening scene in the movie. And then at the end, there's a closing scene of the movie, which is a different interpretation of this.
That's very interesting. Okay, so for the fiction piece, you're going to read chapter 36 and the opening. Can we request the closing for our subscription audiences?
Yes, you can.
Well, we can?
The first chapter actually is not fiction. This is an actual conversation The fiction is the next piece. And then the last piece is also fiction.
Okay, great. So we're going to get the nonfiction piece followed by a fictional opening chapter. That's going to be the next portion of this episode. And then for our subscription audience, you're going to do the closing. Okay, wonderful. So everybody, I hope you're listening and you will subscribe if you haven't already to listen to that closing piece. But before we segue into the creative part, Mort, tell us where our audiences can find you, your work, your book, anything you'd like to share.
Well, the title of the book is A Cup of Tea on the Commode. And if they Google that, we're everywhere. I'm a pretty aggressive marketer. So the website is acupoftheonthecommode.org. I have a YouTube channel, A Cup of Tea on the Commode. We're on TikTok. The official Facebook page has about 25,000 followers. But there's a lot of people around the world that like the story of a son taking care of his mother. It was a lovely thing for me to do. I mean, I got more out of it than I think my mom. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. It was the right thing to do. And I grew up in a very nurturing, loving family that we cared about others. And so this was not a big deal.
Well, I'm definitely going to make sure that my son listens to this because this is music to my ears.
Yeah. It's a good, I think it's not a how-to book. I say it's a what I did book. And if people get something benefit, they'll get a lot of laughs, they'll get a lot of tears, but they may get some tips that I think would benefit, especially a mother, but also any loved one.
Yeah, well, I'm from Punjab, and I always say that the only asset, the true asset that we have that we can use, whatever word you want to apply there, is guilt. So I plan to lay it in.
Good. Okay, super.
Anyway, looking forward to it. This is Mark Stephen Perot reading from A Cup of Tea on the Commode. And Mark, we are in your hands.
Okay, so the chapter title is You Don't See Them, and I'll be doing my mother's voice.
Live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The king stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern, live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.
I don't know why, but I checked on Mom earlier than usual. Most mornings she'd be sound asleep. Occasionally she'd be up and calling for hot tea or cold juice. She'd been a coffee drinker when she was younger, but lost her taste for it during the pregnancy with yours truly. Ever since, hot tea, skim milk, no sugar became her beverage of choice. Feeling partially responsible for the hit taken by the coffee market, I French pressed my fair share of ground Arabica beans to make up for it. But on this particular morning, she surprised me. She was wide awake, unusually chipper, and not at all thirsty. Her hazel eyes twinkled as she gazed out the bedroom window. These days, any activity she saw out there provided more thrills than anything on television. Sometimes it was Dr. Irma, draped in her white lab coat, returning from a long night at Pine Psychiatric Hospital. Sometimes it was Betty, a retired nurse clad in one of her authentic Scottish Highland pure wool kilts, walking Scotty, her Welsh corgi, his belly hovering just above the sidewalk. Sometimes it was a brown cottontail rabbit hopping across the front lawn after gorging on Mom's daisies. But whatever she had seen that day was different. "What's out there, Mama?" "You don't see them?" She pointed to the window. I looked out and saw nothing but a crumbling sidewalk crying for rejuvenation. "See who?" "The children. Heavens to Betsy, look at them all walking by." She smiled and waved at them. I checked again, still saw nothing. "With balloons. Oh, there's one with flowers. Lots of flowers have gone by, too. You recognize anyone?" "I'm sure I do, some of them. There's a yellow balloon. Any relatives?" "Maybe." "Any inviting you to join them?" She answered only with a sly grin. "Mom? No." "Good. You don't see them?" "No, I'm sorry." She says, "Well, if you go out on the sidewalk, you will." "Well, maybe later. Ready for breakfast?" "In a minute." "Okay. Call when you are." There's a girl with daisies. I love daisies. I know, Mama. Enjoy the parade. On my way out, my eyes landed on an old black and white photo hanging on the front wall. In it, 8-year-old Genevieve, dressed in a frilly white dress, white lace socks, and patent leather shoes, sits on a bench holding a posy of daisies. The thought of how perfect this little girl would fit right in with Mom's parade made me chuckle. Well, I'm in many visions during early in our journey. Some were light, some were dark, others were damn entertaining. But this parade of children was the first she described in such detail. And though she would see them walk down Emmett Place many times after, I was relieved that none of the children beckoned her to join them, at least not on that day. So that was pretty much an actual conversation. And she saw this. It was very interesting. So that's true that she saw this vision and described it in such detail. So with that vision, I decided to open the book with a little bit embellished version of that. And what's interesting, I don't know if people can see. So this is the actual picture I'm describing. She's 8 years old. This is my mom sitting on a bench holding flowers. And after I wrote the book, I asked, I think, my siblings if they had any photos. No, I think just out of the blue, my one sister sent me this photo, and I didn't know it existed. I had other photos in mind, but I didn't know this existed. I said, oh my gosh, this is what I wrote about. And so maybe I saw it sometime in my past that I just don't remember. And so that was the cover shot, and it was perfect for it. So
that is amazing and so inspirational to see that you have drawn this picture from a picture, you know, the picture that you just showed us of her sitting on the bench.
Yeah.
So I cannot wait to hear the opening to your fictional opening to a possible screenplay.
So this is called Genevieve's Vision. On a crisp, sunny spring morning, a merry band of well-dressed young children parades down Emmett Place, looking like they just escaped Mass at Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Some skip, few hopscotch, others weave, but most march in unison. The girls, hair in pigtails, ponytails, or pixie cuts, wear frilly white dresses, white lace socks, and patent leather shoes. All carry flowers, a single stem or bouquet. The boys sport combed hair, dress pants, shiny black shoes, and starched white shirts neatly tucked in. Neckties are the norm, but a couple flaunt their individuality with bow ties. Each clad's a string anchoring a brightly colored balloon bobbing to and fro in the wind. The entire procession appears to be from an innocent time long past. As the parade rounds the cul-de-sac and approaches the second house on the end, each child turns, smiles, and waves towards the window on the first floor. Inside, behind a billowy white curtains propped up in a hospital bed, sits a frail 92-year-old Genevieve. Her kind eyes dance with delight as she waves to the children. It's uncertain whether she knows any of them, but that doesn't matter. What does is the long-absent and much-needed joy these children seem to bring her. The last girl, holding a single daisy, stops and beckons Genevieve to join the parade. Amused and tempted, Genevieve chuckles for a moment before a wave of sadness erases her smile. Her eyes drift to an old black and white photo hanging on the front wall. In it sits a girl with a soft brown bob that frames her cherubic face. She, too, wears a frilly white dress, white lace socks, patent leather shoes, and holds a posy of daisies.
Wonderful. Mark, thank you so much. I cannot wait to listen to the closing scene. Now, that, of course, is only for our subscription audiences. So if you're listening to this, please make sure that you subscribe if you haven't already, so you can be sure to listen to Mark's closing scene. Mark, thank you so much for being a guest today on the True Fiction Project.
It was my pleasure.
That was Mark Stephen Perot, a New Jersey native who lives in the south of France. He's an award-winning designer, writer, editor, and now a best-selling award-winning author of a book called A Cup of Tea on the Commode. This is the True Fiction Project. I am your host, Renita Hora. Here at the True Fiction Project, we're always looking for great stories that make for compelling fiction. So if you have a great story or know someone who does, or if you're a writer who'd like to be featured on the show, then please do get in touch with us at renita.com/contact. And if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, then you can do so by visiting substack.com/@Renita Hora, all spelled out one word. That's substack.com/@ReNitaHora. I'll be offering paid subscribers something a little extra special each time, including a video version of this podcast.
Live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The king stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern, live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.